Rendez-vous de la Francophonie is an annual celebration that promotes the French language, heritage, and its numerous cultural expressions. It runs March 2nd to 22nd, 2017 in communities across Canada. The RVF series, which showcases the diversity, duality, and dynamism of Canada's francophone communities, is brought to you by La Fondation Canadienne pour le Dialogue des Cultures, the National Campus and Community Radio Association, Canadian Heritage, and this station. Please stay tuned for the next half hour for this week's edition of Rendez-vous de la Francophonie. Visit ncra.ca/RVF for more information on the series.
Hello, we are here to talk about the Boutelier family that immigrated to Nova Scotia from Europe many, many years ago. Like all families, they married into other family lines and had children, and they married and had children, and so on and so on. Today I'm talking with the mother and daughter of this Boutelier line. The mother is in her 70s, and the daughter is in her 50s. They live completely on the opposite coast of the country in British Columbia. So let us begin this journey back in time.
Meaning of the Boutelier. The Boutelier is a name that means leather bottle maker. It is a nickname for the job that Jehan Quadi had, making wineskins, kind of like canteens now for cowboys made for out of leather. This job eventually became butler, English reference, and the person would be responsible for the house and such, generally a male orientation. Boutelier is the Rhine region of France and Germany and is so close to the border that it can be considered either French or German origin, although French is more likely as bottle in French is Boutelier. The surname Quadi is not overly popular in France at any point in time of history, but there is a concentration of Quadis in the Baden-Württemberg area of Germany still today.
Well, a lot of these people didn't go into the area where the French were already living, like Grand Pré. They ended up in the area around Lüneburg, and this family went to Bayswater. And Bayswater is just a sort of a little farming, fishing community about 10 miles, maybe a little further from Lüneburg. And that's where they set up their farm, and they also were fishermen as well, because everybody fished down there. Here is a picture of my great-grandmother with her oldest daughter who survived. She had seven children, and of that seven, only three actually lived to be adults. And of the three that lived to be adults, only two actually lived to old age. And one was my grandmother, and the other was her sister. So my grandmother was Ella Mary, and her sister was Belle. And the other one was Bessie May, and she was engaged to Tom Arnold, who lived in the area as a farmer, and she died of pneumonia. Of course, they had no penicillin or anything in those days. And when she died, my grandmother, who was living down in Massachusetts and taking a nursing course and was already married to a man named Wood, who had tuberculosis, and he was in a TB sanatorium, and he died. So it all happened around the same time. So my grandmother went back to Nova Scotia and ended up marrying the man that her sister was engaged to, and that became my grandfather. They had two children, but unfortunately, the first one was Thomasina, named after her father. She died at the age of three, and again, it was pneumonia. And 3 years after that, my mother was born, Gladys. Terrible name. I never liked the name Gladys, but anyway, I don't think my mother ever did either. But that was where my mother came in.
History of the Boutelier family of Montbéliard. Montbéliard is a small city in eastern France in the department of Doubs, some 400 kilometers southeast of Paris. Mentioned first in 985 as Mons Belvedere, it became a county of the Holy Roman Empire in the 11th century. So long story short for the Boutelier family is that they left in the 1750s to immigrate to Nova Scotia. They were technically German, not French. About 420 French-speaking Protestants, including the Boutelier's, were brought to Nova Scotia by a Dutch shipping agent named John Dick. Dick wasn't appointed by the British Board of Trade to recruit foreign Protestants along the Rhine to settle in Nova Scotia, which at the time was a remote, a fairly recently acquired British colony. In France in the 16th century, Protestants was based on Calvinism, the belief that salvation was attainable through individual faith alone without the need to worship through the church hierarchy. Huguenots, many of whom were aristocrats, were those who followed these beliefs. There was continual mounting tension between the Catholic state and the Protestants. In 1572, the Saint Bartholomew's Day massacre in Paris killed thousands of helpless Huguenots as they gathered for religious celebrations. In 1685, the Treaty of Nantes, which had allowed Huguenots limited religious freedom, was revoked, escalating persecution. A mass exodus of the Huguenots to England, the Channel Islands, Switzerland, and the Bompenlord. From the early 1700s, Louis XIV placed pressure on the principality in order to gain more territory for France. Although he officially tolerated Lutheranism, many Protestants suffered harassment, if not overt persecution. Many chose to depart from the New World. The majority were listed as farmers, coming from wooded areas, which would stand them in good stead of Nova Scotia. While these immigrants have often been unrecognizing some Swiss immigrants, they have a distinct history. With the help of the Montebellardian descendants, the South Shore Genealogical Society, and a committee headed by Murray Jouret and Paul Jouret, a memorial monument was erected. On July 10, 1988, Pierre Jouret of Audincourt, France, near the city of the Montebellard, unveiled the monument, which read, "This memorial is dedicated to the memory of the 431 foreign Protestants from the Principality of Montebellard who landed in Nova Scotia between 1749 and 1752. Many of these Montebellardians were among the founding settlers of Lunenburg on June 8, 1753.
And we lived in the Annapolis Valley, and that's where Grand Pré is, and that's where a lot of the French were evicted from Nova Scotia by the British in 1763, something like that. And it was pretty brutal. They divided families up. They put a lot of the men in the church and set the church on fire. And they didn't care if they separated children from parents or what. They just threw them on ships. Some went to New Orleans. Some went to northern Nova Scotia, to Cape Breton Island. Some went up the Bay of Fundy to Weymouth, Nova Scotia, which is still what they call the French Shore down there. And some went to New Brunswick. And I don't think any of them ever they got as far as Quebec, where most of the French already were. Maybe it was because there wasn't that many more people to distribute around. Now, our family, the Boutelier family, came from France originally. And they were Huguenots, which meant they were Protestants in a very Catholic country. And at that time, Catholicism was very, very high, and the Pope ruled the world. And so the French Protestants were persecuted by the Catholics, and a lot of them were just out and out brutally murdered. And many of them were just kicked out of their homes, taken from their homes and kicked out. And some of them were lucky enough to get to ships. So it wasn't that long after 1752 that my grandmother was born in Nova Scotia. But she wasn't born in Bayswater. She was born in... My grandmother was born in 1877. Aunt Belle was born in 1874. But Bessie May was born after my grandmother.
Yeah. 1878, 79.
Okay, well, there's an island just outside of the port of Halifax called George's Island. And during the... Halifax was called the Warden of the North because of its location and its fine harbor, great harbor. And so it was also a huge military base, Navy as well as British Army. And it was all British, of course. And George's Island was where they had the gallows set up for any deserters. And if they got caught, they were hung and left hanging until their bodies rotted and they fell off the gibbets. And that was the end of it. So I find it interesting that they landed the people from that ship on George's Island. Here it is. The Betty and the Speedwell traveled together. The Betty's passengers were landed on St. George's Island. So they must have been put in boats and then taken right across to Halifax. It's only about maybe 200 yards from that island to Halifax. Maybe a bit more, but not much. There was more illness than usual, and it continued for a time after landing, which is likely why the passengers had to stay on board for almost a month after arrival. Two of our bootleer ancestors died on the voyage. They were the parents of the bootleer, who was 21 at that time, that we are descended from. The master of the Sally died on the voyage as well. So the bootleer that we were descended from was the youngest one, who was age 21. Two of our bootleer ancestors died on the voyage. They were the parents of the bootleer, who was 21 at that time.
And I see my old friends coming in through the door. I taste the salt of the spray on my face, and I feel my heartbeat for that one special place. I'm home in my harbor at the edge of the sea, and when we are parted, she calls out to me, come home again, lover, won't you come home to me? Home in your harbor at the edge of the sea. Firelight, I taste the kitchen tea here in my hand. The farther away, the closer I am. I'm home in my...
The passenger list for Ship Sally, 1752 to Nova Scotia, 30th of May, 1752. Passengers were Jean-Georges Bootleer, who was 50, Jacques Bootleer, 33, Jean-Nicolas Bootleer, 21, Jacques Bootleer, 17. The British governing board that looked after the settlement of Nova Scotia sought out foreign non-British Protestants. The English were hard to persuade to immigrate and often did not work out very well as settlers. The colonies to the south had good results with foreign Protestants and found them very hardworking and capable of settling new areas. So it was decided to recruit European Protestants from Nova Scotia as well. Roman Catholics were not welcome. The British government hired John Dick of Rotterdam as their agent to procure the immigrants and arrange for the transfer to Nova Scotia. Dick sent agents up the Rhine River to find settlers. Posters and handbills were used to give the word out that the new colony of Nova Scotia was open for settlement. There was a lot of competition between agents for the various colonies in those days, and competing agents spread rumors about how awful the Nova Scotian climate was, the lack of agricultural prospects, and the ferociousness of the Indian attacks. Also, once settlers arrived at Rotterdam, they were sometimes convinced by another agent to sail for another colony. Settlers were responsible for their own passage down the Rhine, although Dick's agents would help to arrange it. Tolls had to be paid along the way as the boats moved through different principalities, and this would also slow down the voyage. The settlers were mostly redemptions. This meant that in return for the passage across the Atlantic, they owed the British government labor when they arrived in the new colony. Some passengers with the means to pay their own way chose to be redemption instead, so that they could save their money and to help them get established in their new land. And this was likely a good idea. The board preferred as much as possible that the young single men be recruited, but in actual fact, many families and even older family members made the voyage. This was probably for the best in the long run, as records show that the families were not likely to remain in Nova Scotia and settle down there. There were some complaints from the board as to the fact that the older people were allowed to make the voyage, but entire families often moved together. The board preferred as much as possible that the young single men be recruited, but in actual fact, in many families and even older family members made the voyage. This was probably for the best in the long run, and as records show, that the families were more likely to remain in Nova Scotia and settle down there. The Betty and the Speedwell traveled together. The Betty's passengers were landed on St. George Island. The Sally, 1752, sailed from Rotterdam. It arrived the 26th of August, 1752, and not allowed to disembark until September 26. The voyage lasted 90 days on board. Number of souls who left Rotterdam was 258. Number of alive in Halifax, 218. The number of deaths on the voyage was 39, including two of our ancestors. It was a long and stormy passage. There was more illness than usual, and it continued for a time after landing, which is likely why the passengers had to stay on board for almost a month after arrival. Two of our bootleer ancestors died on the voyage. They were the parents of the bootleer, who was 21 at the time. The master of the Sally died on the voyage as well. Sarah Grange, who was married to Jean-Georges Bootleer, were married on the 19th of January 1722. And they were the couple who died on the Sally on the way over, and we were buried at the sea. The accommodations were horrific. They were 6 feet square, which represented four freights, was equivalent to four adults over the age of 14. Kids 4 to 14 were considered half a freight, and under 4 were carried free. Berths were raised wooden structures with a space underneath them for baggage. Berths were not completely divided off from each other in order to allow air to circulate. The headroom with the berth was less than 4 feet and sometimes as low as 2 feet 9 inches in those places where there was room for double berths. Altogether, it sounds rather claustrophobic and crowded. Some of the ships stopped in England to replenish their food and water before setting out on the ocean crossing. Food and drink was often scanty and insufficient. With food turning putrid and wormy before the end of the voyage and water being incredibly foul, especially towards the end of the voyage, the water would have a disgusting smell and taste, and there were often long, green, slimy growths within the water supply. Sometimes gin, brandy, or possibly even vinegar would be added when drinking it to make it more palatable. Vinegar was also sometimes sprinkled around because of the stench in the air. At that time, sickness was believed to come from the air, and to counteract the smell on the ship, it was believed that would counteract disease to some degree. Here is a schedule of rations for 1 week for one of Dick's ships. Sunday, 1 pound of boiled beef with as much boiled rice as they could eat. Monday, barley or groats boiled. Tuesday, 1 pound boiled beef with as much boiled rice as they can eat. Wednesday, barley or rice boiled as on Mondays. Thursday, half a pound of pork and a pound of flour. Friday, as much stockfish, dried salt codfish boiled as they chose and 1 pound of butter. And Saturday, boiled peas and a pound of cheese. A measure equal 1 quart of beer every day as long as it keeps good. and 2 measures of water and 6 pounds of bread per week, and some gin to be distributed by the captain as he sees fit. Children received half the rations as adults. Immigrants may have had to prepare some of their own food on ship. It is not really known. Fire grates on deck for cooking were common on the ships at that time, although at least some of the food on Dick's ship seems to have been provided cooked. One account from the time, but not from these ships, tells passengers collecting on deck and taking turns at the fire grates to make a sort of bannock out of their flour rations, which was often burnt. Children aged 1 to 7 often died on the voyage, especially the infants. When the ships arrived in Halifax, they were detained for a period of 5 to 21 days due to illness or there being no place to put the new immigrants. After spending a couple of months at sea and some time before departure back in Europe, cooped up in a ship, it must have been very frustrating to have arrived at their destination and not be allowed off. All ships except the Anne had ventilators that were supposed to run 1 hour out of 4 to exchange air in the hold with fresh air, except during storm weather. Many of the ships also had a physician of sorts, and there were medicine chests. Many of these physicians were very young, and training for doctors in those times were not very rigorous.
Well, my grandmother did, because my grandmother lived with us from before I was born, because her husband died before I was born. So she was on her own. Mom was her only child. So she moved in with my parents and my sister and I, because there was just the two of us then. And she made all kinds of medicine for us, like cough medicine, where she'd boil up onions and mix it with molasses. And it worked. It really did. It worked. Also, medicine for croup, lemon and honey, and goose grease rubs for on your chest. So all these kind of things, and they all came from her childhood and her background. And same with the fishing industry. It was, everybody was either farmers or fishermen or both. And the Blue Nose, which is the famous schooner, which is on the back of all our dimes here in Canada, was part of all that tradition. And the captain of the schooner of the Blue Nose was Captain Angus Walters. And he lived in the apartment just above my parents because he married late in life. And they raced that Blue Nose against fishing schooners from Massachusetts. And the Blue Nose won every time. There's even a song out about it. Never took a, well, how's that go? I forget how it goes now. Charlie can sing it. My brother can sing it. Never lost a race and kept her place in the history of Canada. Yeah, it was a great song. I think it was actually an ad for Olin's Brew, but it was good.
I've got a story to tell of a proud ship that served her people well. Well, the Blue Nose was her name, and she never lost a race, and she won herself a place in the history of Canada. Blow, winds blow, for the Blue Nose is sailing once again. So beat to the windward once more, and up cheer before sail as before, for your country will be proud once again of the ship and the men who sailed her smartly into victory. Blow, winds blow, for the Blue Nose is sailing once again. Built in a Nova Scotia town, where the shipwrights had gained the world renown. Down in Lunenburg they built a living legend out of skill, sweat and pride, and sailed her masterfully till she died. Blow, winds blow, for the Blue Nose is sailing once again. So beat to the windward once more, and up jib and foresail as before, for your country will be proud once again of the ship and the men who sailed her smartly into victory. Blow, winds blow, for the Blue Nose is sailing once again. So beat to the windward once more, and up jib and foresail as before, for your country will be proud once again of the ship and the men who
sailors sparkly into victory. Blow, wind, blow, for the Blue Nose is sailing once again. For the Blue Nose is sailing once again. For the Blue Nose is sailing once again.
All those bootleggers in that graveyard behind their home. When Mom and I went down there, and I think it was 1974, we went driving around looking for it, and we found it. We were quite surprised. We knocked on the door and told them who we were and who our ancestors were, and we were quite surprised to find that there were still bootleggers living there who were related. So they invited us in. There was a story about a small trunk that was sent over with the first bootleggers that fled from France with 100, I guess francs would have been the money for France at that time, in it. And it was supposed to be passed on to the senior member of each family as they grew and refilled. And of course it was empty by the time we saw it. And also they showed us where they had restored the house and had torn away some of the wall and found these beautiful old brick ovens where they used to bake the bread and everything. And that was really cool. Because you just don't see those today, you know. So here's my grandfather's confirmation certificate. We're all, at that part of the story, we were all Anglicans by then, based on a Jewish background, on the Umlaw family. There was three Umlaw brothers who came here to Canada from England, and they were Jewish. And two of them stayed in Nova Scotia. No, one stayed in Nova Scotia. That was my grandfather, my great-grandfather, my great-grandfather. And the other two went to Worcester, Massachusetts, and remained Jewish. My grandfather became an Anglican priest. And then his son became an Anglican priest. And his son, my cousin George, became the Anglican Archbishop of Nova Scotia and PEI. And that was all on my mother's side of the family through the Umlaw family, not through the bootleggers. The bootleggers were all for Protestant Huguenots. Yeah. So that was pretty interesting.
Well, that's it for this interview. Hope you found this interesting. I sure did. A little insight to a French family that came from Nova Scotia. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for joining us for this week's edition of Rendez-vous de la Francophonie, presented by La Fondation Canadienne pour le Dialogue des Cultures, the National Camps and Community Radio Association, Canadian Heritage, and the station. To learn more about the RVF series and the National RVF Celebration, and to send us your comments, visit ncra.ca/RVF.